Chapter 47. The History of Modern Philosophy. Section A. The Modernity Movement. As we said, modo in Latin means now, hence modernus, or modern. There is nothing special about being modern. We are all, in fact, modern, since we are alive now. But the way they began to use this term in the 14th century had a very special connotation. It implied a rejection of what had been received from the immediate past. Man felt self-sufficient and unwilling to acknowledge any indebtedness. He wanted to find things out by himself rather than being taught, like the child who is too proud to ask for help. Among other things, the Renaissance was a time of economic prosperity, new lands to be exploited, new sources of raw materials, new markets, new techniques of production, inventions like the printing press and gunpowder, ... With an increasing urge to enjoy the pleasures of life and to look down on the recent past, which could not be easily accepted as a teacher, those moderns felt that they had nothing to learn from their forebears, that now is better than yesterday. This is typical of modern philosophy, a contempt for the past, which is self-defeating, since it dooms itself to be despised in turn by tomorrow's present. Specifically, modern philosophy largely rejects the Christian faith with its supernatural knowledge as something given to man, received by man, which the pride of man finds it's hard to accept. Modern man wants to find out by himself, rather than being spoon-fed by God, let alone by the church. He wants to construct his own ideas about God and about the church, rather than depend on a knowledge handed on by forebears. Of course, traditionalism, or the blind and unthinking acceptance of tradition for its own sake, is as wrong as this foolish progressivism. But progressivism is usually stronger because it's more destructive. In the Renaissance, along with an upsurge of artistic and scientific creativity, there was a shift away from the faith and supernatural knowledge to reason and natural knowledge. The germs of the subsequent rationalism and naturalism associated with the humanist ideals of Freemasonry. This is why there was a revival of pagan philosophy and culture, accompanied by a movement of independence from the faith by rejecting its guidance, as the temporal power of secular rulers who became more self-assertive in relation to the church. They wanted reason to go on its own. Why should reason be guided by the faith? This is the spirit of modern philosophy. A second thing that was rejected was the dependence of human reason on being, i.e., on reality outside reason. The active intellect took over from the contemplative intellect. Thus, modernitas, or modernity, as they called the movement, rejected 1. The past, 2. The faith, and 3. Eventually, reality itself, idealism. In short, anything that would teach them anything. Man wanted to find the whole truth out for himself and by himself. Neither God, nor the church, nor the world, nor history should teach me. I am the one to find out the truth by myself. For modernity, therefore, philosophy no longer consists in contemplating the reality created by God and drawing therefrom the rules for human conduct, see chapter 34, section C, but in providing power for man to master the world and use it for his own happiness. Section B, Humanism. This approach ends up in immanentism, see chapter 21, section J, a philosophy which begins and ends in man, remains in man, immanere, to remain in. It is the philosophy of human egoism, of the individualism characteristic of Protestantism and liberalism. It means also that every man has to start his own philosophy. He should not receive what others have thought out. This is the reason for the proliferation of philosophical systems ever since, parallel to the proliferation of Protestant sects. These systems are all quite impressive as a rule, but characteristically separated from reality, since they want to subjugate it rather than to accept it. They are full of subjectivity, willfulness, imagination, and emotion, but as dangerous to man and society as fiction is separated from real life. Thus, it can also be called humanism, in the sense that all reality is reduced to and centered in man. This humanism, then, splits into 1. Individualistic humanism, the only thing that matters is myself. Man applies to himself the divine definition, I am who am. And 2. Collectivistic humanism, the only thing that matters is man, i.e., the ideal man, the collective man, society as such. Liberalism, leading to anarchism, is the former. Socialism, leading to communism, is the latter. Their common root is a humanism that has rejected God and has humanized everything, including religion. Nothing transcends man. Hence, immanence and immanentism, which is the opposite of transcendence. See Chapter 5, Section A. This process of humanization of culture and philosophy was aided, as we have observed, by the decadence of a Christian philosophy in the throes of formalism. Once the philosophy of St. Thomas is turned into a formalism, i.e., into a system of ideas, it loses its congenital realism. What St. Thomas was all the time looking at was reality, i.e., the reality created by God and visible through the senses. But what other philosophers look at is ideas in their own minds and end up confusing them with reality and thinking that reality, including God, is a creation of the human mind. See Chapter 8, Section D. Section C, Modern Philosophy and the Church. Contact with modern philosophy, therefore, requires in the Christian a great sense of fidelity to the Church and its teaching authority, realizing the deeply anti-Christian beginnings of it. No one is free from the temptations of modern thought, as no one is free from selfish passion and pride. Personal piety and humility are essential, as well as sincere obedience to the magisterium of the Church. Modern philosophy, however, cannot be ignored by the Christian, since otherwise he is in great danger of being deceived by it, as it pervades the means of social communication and the world of education and culture. The Church has denounced its errors, while never denying its achievements, many times, as in the syllabus issued by Pius IX in 1864 in the First Vatican Council of 1869 to 1870, in the many encyclicals of Leo XIII, particularly Aeterni Patris in 1879, in the encyclical Patiendi of St. Pius X, 1907, condemning modernism as a compendium of heresies stemming from modern philosophy, in the encyclical of Humani Generis of Pius XII, 1950, down to Paul VI, who spoke several times about neo-modernism, and John Paul II, who in a recent homily in 1979 stated that a culture that is deliberately anti-metaphysical logically produces an agnostic and neo-pagan society, in spite of the praiseworthy efforts of honest persons concerned about the destiny of mankind. Besides, Pius XI condemned Marxist communism, a typical product of modern philosophy, as a totalitarian philosophy based on atheism in the encyclical Divini Redemptoris in 1937. The approach of the Church, however, has not been confined to exposing and condemning errors. She has in fact gone to the limit in taking pains to welcome whatever truth and wisdom and goodness there is still in modern philosophy, whatever genuine humanism is still in conformity with the Christian and metaphysical conception of man as Imago Dei, as attested by such documents as the encyclical Pacem in Terris of John the 23rd in 1963, the encyclical Ecclesiam Suum, first of Paul's VI's pontificate in 1964, the pastoral constitution Gaudium et Spes of the Second Vatican Council in 1965, and above all the first encyclical of Jean-Paul II, Redemptor Hominis, in 1979. Section D, René Descartes, 1596-1650. Descartes is the first modern philosopher. In him and Kant are most characteristically found all the features of modern thought. This is why we shall concentrate on these two, referring the reader to any standard history for all the rest. Descartes' chief work is the Discourse on Method, whose starting point is the rejection of all received knowledge, whether from the faith, from the past, or from the senses. See section A and B. This leaves me alone with my thought. I am thinking, cogito in Latin. So cogito becomes the starting point of philosophy. After having cast the faith, the past, and the senses into doubt, cogito becomes the first certainty. But doubt and certainty are two subjective states of mind. Therefore, philosophy becomes subjective thinking, centered on man, no longer on reality. The only certainty I have, says Descartes, is that I am thinking. Therefore, this has to be the beginning of philosophy, and it means that my being is thinking. It is by thinking that I am. In Latin, cogito ergo sum. This is the essence of modern philosophy, making human thought the center of all reality, subjectifying reality. Previously, Protestantism had subjectified the faith. Descartes was now subjectifying reason. The humanist trend, see chapter 44, section B, the tide had not stopped ever since, despite all the effort of the church to make man return to God as the only foundation and guarantor of a genuine humanism that truly loves man and respects his dignity and rights. A great deal of doctrine, piety, and humility is needed not to be swept by this tide. From the cogito, Descartes proceeds to prove the existence of God. He could not do so, as St. Thomas does, by starting from sense experience, see chapter 21 and 22. As he had cast all sense knowledge into doubt, he was sure only of his own thinking, not of what the thinking was about, but of the thinking itself. Descartes is sure only of himself. And how does he prove that God exists then? He says, I have the innate idea of the most perfect being, but I am not the most perfect being. Therefore, there must be a most perfect being who has put this idea into my mind. This, however, does not prove anything. St. Thomas has already rejected this kind of argument, saying that from an idea, one cannot prove the existence of anything in reality. In order to do this, one has to start from reality itself, not from an idea in the mind. Many philosophers after Descartes rejected his argument for the existence of God, while fully accepting his subjective starting point, and ending up either in agnosticism or in downright atheism. Regarding man, Descartes also runs into difficulties, since he is put into doubt what he receives through the senses. How do we know that we have a body? We feel our body through the senses. Therefore, I have to doubt the existence of my body. I cannot be sure of it. On the other hand, I am sure that I am thinking. Therefore, my thinking must be something different from my body, namely, the soul, the spiritual soul, as distinct from the material body. What I am sure of, therefore, is that I am a soul, and that the being of my soul is thinking. My thinking is my being. See chapter 25, sections B and C. And what about my body? I will have to prove whether it exists or not. And I have to prove this through ideas, through thinking. He proves it in this way. In my sensations, I feel passive, i.e., at the receiving end. I cannot change them at will. I receive them. Consequently, there must be something outside me that causes my sensations, and this can only be either God or the things themselves. But the most perfect being would not deceive me by making me feel that there are things outside me which would not in fact exist. And so it must be the things themselves that cause my sensations of them. Thus, he proves the existence of the world outside himself by means of the idea of cause, which presumably must be innate too. He thereby inverts the natural order of things by proving what is most evident, the world, through what is less evident, an idea in my mind. Another manifestation of his subjectivism. This Cartesian theory also came under fire from many subsequent philosophers, but they all likewise retained the subjective, immanentistic starting point. What is man then for Descartes? A spirit and a body neatly dichotomized and essentially different. See chapter 25, section B and C. The latter is nothing but extension, and the former is pure thought. Man is a ghost in a machine. This is the Cartesian idea of man, already at odds with Christianity and with the metaphysics of Esse. See the Appendix 2 and Passim in Metaphysics of Man. Descartes splits man into two instead of distinguishing in order to unite. See chapter 46, section E. He separates or dichotomizes. This is also a consequence of his subjectivism, which makes him accept ideas only if they are clear and distinct, like mathematical ideas, because only they beget certainty in the mind. Truth is not what matters, but certainty. This is what leads him to reduce the idea of spirit to thought, and the idea of matter to extension. How then do soul and body communicate in man if they exclude each other so sharply, so mathematically? The soul is active and qualitative, the body is passive and quantitative. How can they communicate with each other? Here he turns to philosophy fiction, contradicting his own principle of accepting only clear and distinct ideas. He turns to a nebulous theory according to which there are certain vapors called animal spirits through which body and soul communicate, and which are emitted by the pineal gland in the brain. Because this gland is the only asymmetrical point of the human body, this is a standard joke in the history of philosophy. Of course, nobody accepted this theory, but again, most thinkers have accepted his subjective starting point, branching off then into either idealism, all is thought, or materialism, all is matter. Lastly, Cartesian ethics can be summarized in three principles. 1. Reason can know God and all that is in man, rationalism. 2. The only virtue we should practice is firmness in following our own reason, voluntarism. 3. We should not wish what is impossible and should not repent from our errors, humanism. Section E, Immanuel Kant, 1724-1804. After Descartes, there were two schools of thought. One was rationalism, which understood reason as intelligence, and the other was a rationalism which identified reason with sensibility, empiricism. The former was inclined to idealism, and the latter to materialism, but both stemmed from the same Cartesian principle of immanence. Cogito. Let us recall the Cartesian dichotomy of man. Man as spirit, intelligence. Rationalism, ideas come from human mind. Spinoza, Malebranche, Leibniz, Wolff. Man as body, sensibility. Empiricism, ideas come from sense experience. Hobbes, Locke, Berkeley, Hume. For both wings of Cartesianism, However, ideas come from man. Both agree that all that exists is given to man in his consciousness, in his thinking. But while, for rationalists, thinking is abstract thinking, rational consciousness, for empiricists, thinking is feeling and imagining, sensible consciousness. What Kant attempted was a synthesis of both. Thus, he constructed a theory of knowledge based on a critique of all the knowing powers of man. In his Critique of Pure Reason, he made a critique of sensibility, understanding, and reason. He also dichotomizes or splits man into those three knowing powers, the lowest of which is sensibility, above which is understanding, and at the top is reason. His approach is therefore wrong from the start, because in man, knowing is a single unified process, not three different steps. Sensibility and understanding, as we have seen in the metaphysics of man, are distinct but not separated, united but not confused. See chapters 26 and 27. Kant's chief concern was to discover the ground of scientific knowledge, i.e. knowledge which is universal and necessary, as opposed to particular and contingent. For empiricism, all our knowledge is particular and contingent, because we cannot generalize from sense impressions, and so there is no ground for any scientific statement. Kant, as a rationalist, confronted the empiricists by countering that there are two sciences which for him were beyond any doubt universal and necessary, namely physics and ethics. The proposition or statements of both these sciences are, he observed, universal and necessary, but at the same time they are based on sensible experience, as the physics of Newton and the ethics of Rousseau demonstrate. Newton's physics is all based on experiment and observation, but its conclusions are universal and necessary. Rousseau's ethics was purely subjective. I must be true to myself. I must be what I feel is right. A man-centered ethics, but nevertheless universal and necessary, i.e. intended for every man necessarily. Now, if universality and necessity cannot come from sense experience, in this Kant agreed with the empiricists, i.e. from outside the mind, it must come from inside the mind. It must be precisely the contribution our mind makes to our knowledge. Therefore, our knowledge is a synthesis of 1. Data from outside the mind, and 2. The mind's own forms or empty mental molds into which the data are cast and thus objectified for the mind. While 1. Is the matter or content of our knowledge, 2. Is the form of it. Kant calls the purely mental element, which does not come from experience, a priori, and so speaks of the a priori forms inherent in the mind, prior to any experience, similar to the innate ideas of Descartes, but without content. On the other hand, what does come from experience is a posteriori, and supplies the content of our knowledge, which is then synthesized with a priori forms, and thereby becomes universal and necessary. Thus the mind adapts reality to itself, or objectifies it into phenomena, i.e. things as they appear to the mind, while the noumenon, i.e. the thinkable, or what the thing is in itself, remains unknown. This agnosticism leads Kant to conclude that we cannot know what is beyond our sense experience, such as the world as a totality, the soul, and God. These are the three pure ideas of reason beyond understanding, which cannot be synthesized with any sense experience, and about which, therefore, we can know nothing. Thus, with Kant, human consciousness encloses itself within itself more radically by excluding any knowledge of things in themselves. Post-Kantian idealism went on to exclude even the existence of things in themselves. Reality becomes a creation of man. For Kant, the a priori forms of sensibility are space and time. Those of understanding are what he calls the 12 categories or concepts, with which we unify our sense perceptions into universal and necessary statements, such as the concept of cause, which is therefore valid only when applied to observable phenomena. This is why, according to him, we cannot prove the existence of God as the cause of the world with pure reason alone, since God is beyond sense experience. For Kant, as we said, God, like world and soul, is an a priori form, or idea of reason, with no counterpart in sense experience. Those pure ideas of reason are no more than the forms with which we unify all our experiences, the external ones into the idea of world, the internal ones into the idea of soul, and all of them into the idea of God. In his second critique, the Critique of Practical Reason, Kant surpasses the conclusions of the first one. Here he turns his attention to ethics. In the first critique, he had concluded that while physics is possible as a science because of its sensible content, metaphysics, on the other hand, has no basis as a science. It is only a natural disposition of our mind trying to unify all experience. Ethics, however, Kant claims, can be a basis for metaphysics, the very opposite of what we have been saying all the while, especially in chapter 10 and 34. Because the statements of ethics are categorical imperatives, I must do this, I must avoid that, and so forth, and they are universal and necessary, as they are meant to be valid for anyone in that situation. Therefore, they are a priori, but also synthetic, like the propositions of physics, i.e., with a sensible content, since the empirical ego, which feels those imperatives, is also sensible. Here is, then, another valid science. Now, if these moral propositions are true, i.e., objective, they imply the existence of, 1. God. There must be someone who rewards and punishes, or otherwise there would be no necessity in those categorical imperatives, and 2. The soul, both free, the imperatives are unconditioned, hence the soul must be unconditioned, as opposed to the body, which is necessitated, and immortal, since virtue is not always rewarded in this life, and vice not always punished, and so the soul must survive the body. Consequently, Kant considers God and the soul as postulates of practical reason, what pure reason is unable to do, namely, to reach a noumenon, God and the soul, in this case. Practical reason does with its moral categorical imperatives. Practical reason is autonomous, auto equals self, nomos equals law, i.e., it dictates the law, while pure reason, heteronomous, i.e., it receives the law from outside itself. So, practical reason is the realm of freedom, while pure reason is the realm of necessity. This means that morality is not rooted in metaphysics, but in the very structure of the human mind. The post-Kantian idealists would make the human mind not only the root of morality, but the creator of everything, and the Marxists would make revolutionary praxis not only the creator of everything, but the criterion of truth. This is the sequel of both the Kantian separation of practical and pure reason and the inversion of their natural sequence. In order to act practical reason, we must know pure or speculative reason. See chapter 6, section C, and chapter 38, section F. But in Kant and in Marxism, this natural order is inverted. Lastly, in his third critique, the Critique of Judgment, Kant looks for a source that would unify the two reasons, and thus unite the world of necessity, physics, and the world of freedom, ethics, something deeper than either pure or practical reason, namely the human spirit, Geist. And he finds an avenue into it in what he calls feeling, thus showing the deep influence of his contemporary romantic poets and artists like Goethe, who exalted the boundless freedom of feeling and rebelled against the law-abiding necessity of reason. This was the transition from rationalism to romanticism, from the cult of reason to the cult of feeling, but always within immanentism, always starting from the Cartesian cogito, or principle of immanence. It ushers in the age of revolution in which we are immersed. In fact, Kant claimed to have accomplished two Copernican revolutions in philosophy. One, it is not the mind that rotates around reality, but the other way around. Two, it is not action, practical reason, that follows knowledge, pure reason, but the other way around.